Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hi, this is Bob McCowan. John Shannon and I are taking the week off. I know. But everybody's got to have a week off. While you're sitting there, here's one of the best of the Bob McCowan podcasts. Hope you enjoy it. And we'll see you back here live next week. Bob McCowan podcast featuring John Shannon.
Whoa, am I in the title now?
No, you're not in the title. You're after featuring. Oh. You're on like the third line.
Wait, this is progress, Bob.
No, it's not progress at all.
It is progress. You've made my day. I feel so much better.
That's what I live for, John, is to make your day. And joining us is the CEO of Uninterrupted Canada, but better known as the former president of Sportsnet and all television and radio properties, and even better known as Thing 2. Here is Scott Moore. Look at you.
I still have the t-shirt. It says Thing 2.
Really?
Judy Davey from Molson sent us, sent Keith and I Thing 1 and Thing 2 t-shirts back when you first named us that.
Now, you're referring to Keith Pelley. Have you talked to him? Do you still stay in touch with him?
Yeah, I keep in touch with him. I talk to him every couple of weeks. He's doing great. Last I talked to him, the European tour was just getting back up right. and running. So he was busy. But the previous 6 to 8 weeks, he said, had been the toughest weeks of his career because they were worried just about cash flowing and making sure that the tour offices were going to stay open. He had to furlough some people. Yeah, they went through some tough times, but I think they're coming back pretty well.
Welcome to the rest of the sports media world, right?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look, before we get into some meat and potatoes here, take a second. Tell us, there got to be some people out there who don't know what Uninterrupted Canada is, and maybe you can give us the very brief synopsis of the company.
Sure. Uninterrupted was formed by LeBron James. It's his athlete empowerment platform. So it's a digital platform. It produces content mostly from the athlete's voice. And in the States, they do deals with Disney, ESPN, Fox for long-form programming. And then they do a lot of short-form digital programming. So we're the first international expansion of that. LeBron is a partner. Drake is a partner. Then my Canadian business partner, Vinay Vermani, is the chief content officer. And I'm the CEO. We've done a deal with Bell Media where they're our distribution partner. We've done our first long-form documentary last November, which was on Serge Ibaka going back to the Congo right. with the Larry Ryan Trophy. We've got another documentary coming up on the Nurse family and their sort of dominance of their individual sports. And we do short-form content as well. And we did something with Serge Ibaka called the Vet Class that went a little viral in the fall. We have a couple of other branded content series. And we went through a little slowdown during COVID, but things are rushing back in the last week or so. And we're having a tough time keeping up.
Good.
You sound busy, though.
Yeah, it's busy. It's fun. It's different. It's a little bit more hands-on. We've got a small team. But it's a fun team. And I think if you add up the ages of everybody else on the team, you come close to getting to my age.
Oh, man, that's old.
Everybody's young. Yeah, everybody's young. Well, it's great.
As I was reminded somewhere earlier, this might be the world's oldest podcast. So,
yeah. you're not bringing the age down much more. No. I got news for you. So,
and you're like number one or two of sports podcasts in Canada right now, Bob?
Well, it comes and goes, you know. I don't know. I can't keep track.
You mean the one featuring John Shannon?
Yeah, that same one. Yeah.
Oh wow, that's good.
And ain't no telling how can you be higher than number one? Because if I get rid of you, no doubt we'll go up. Yeah. But
are you talking to Scott?
No, yeah. I'm talking to you. You sorry. Know who I'm talking to.
The celebrity guests really drive it. And this is the best you could do. Somebody who's actually once met Drake and once met LeBron. That's the biggest celebrity you can get.
Yeah, what's LeBron like?
LeBron's actually a great guy. The funniest thing was at our launch last August. I introduced him on stage, and he came up, and I should have gotten a lesson from Adam Silver as to how to hug an NBA player and not look like a geeky old guy, because I looked like a geeky old guy. But he got up and said, we're thrilled to be in Canada, and it's all because of my brother Scott Moore, which I thought was – I turned to my wife. We were standing off stage. I said, I think the best NBA player in history just called me his brother, which is pretty cool. Might have been a career highlight.
Inaccurate, but very cool indeed.
Yes, yes.
And by the way, if you need Drake, he lives right over there. He's about a drive and a four iron from me, so don't worry about it.
He used to live. I'm at our condo at the Ritz Carlton downtown, and he used to live on the 41st floor. While he was building.
Now has a little shack in Bridal Path.
Okay, you two name droppers. The closest I got to Drake was Degrassi. Okay, that's it. All right. I mean, that's it.
And you watch.
His place is so big, he thinks yours is his garden shed, right?
Oh, God, yeah. I think he's got 60,000 square feet.
He can land his plane in the backyard, can't he? I mean, is that...
Well, not quite, but he could certainly land a helicopter. He may even have a helicopter pad on the roof, for all I know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, are you watching any hockey?
Watching a fair bit of hockey, not as much as I have in previous years. It's tough to get really into it in the middle of August. I've got a lot of other things going at the moment. And the only thing I miss from it is, you know, playoff hockey is so much about the crowd and so much about the atmosphere that that's been a little tough. And really? I miss that. Mm-hmm. Oh. But
I've loved it. It's been great. I think they've done a marvelous job.
I think the league has done an amazing job of how the arenas look. I think they've done the best job. The NBA playoffs look good, but because they've brought the screens in so close to the court, it looks so small. Whereas I think the arenas look great. The two arenas have done a terrific job.
The NBA, it looks like a gym. It looks just like a
absolutely.
Gym.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas the NHL made it look big. I love the use of the big monitors on one side. Mm-hmm. And the guys who are doing audio, John and I like to geek out on the TV production side, but the guys who are doing the audio to add the crowd enhancements, they've been doing an outstanding job. I think it's Jeff Kozak in Edmonton. And I was talking to a former director that both John and I worked with, Larry Brown, and he was marveling that Jeff Kozak was throwing in some oohs and ahs when there was a post hit.
Well, I mean, the magic of that is this, as we get deeper into the bubbles, they become much more comfortable with when to use it, how to use it.
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing three games a day, they get tired too. When you only have one game a day, you can actually plan it a little more. I do think that at key times when you get a referee wiping out a goal and you can hear a murmur, it does make it a little more effective.
That's pretty impressive. The only thing I was a little surprised at, again, from a TV standpoint, I thought because there is nobody in the stands, they might have found a few more new camera angles or different camera angles that we wouldn't normally be able to do with crowd in the stands. They've used the crane camera that NBC developed underneath the scoreboard, which has been all right. But I would have thought they could have done a couple of other things. But
I think they did have to go, and I've been saying this all along through the pandemic, they had an opportunity to go lower and closer.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, they haven't gone lower and closer. They've gone higher and wider. With the it's called a JIDA, jib in the air. So that's the one thing that it's effective. Sure, I don't want to see it. I mean, everybody has problems watching the puck anyway and following the puck, even if you're Canadian. Mm-hmm. And you trust the game camera to go with the flow. So you trust that the puck is going that way. Well, the new high-wide Jitta camera doesn't really move very much, so you don't know where the puck is. And you don't follow the flow of the puck. And so much of our game is about flow, as opposed to I see that little one-inch thick, three-inch black dot on the ice. They have to find a way. Lower and closer would have been my preference. But from a world feed sense and replays, I think they've done okay. They haven't embarrassed themselves, that's for sure.
Yeah, but if you watch the NBA, they did the low tracking camera along the one side. And they can do that because there's nobody sitting courtside, right?
Right.
So could you have done something more like that on hockey? But those things are expensive.
Here's what I would have done.
Right now.
Here's what I would have done. And I actually lobbied a few people. And I wasn't going to say it, but now that you're here, I'll say it. What I would have done was, because there's no stands, I would have moved the stands back 10 feet. Mm-hmm. And I would have allowed for, on the concrete outside the boards, I would have put two steady cams. Mm-hmm. And put a steady cam so that cameraman could walk from behind the goal all the way to the penalty box on either side. And so he could have followed play, but he could also move to set up plays. He could, because it's a steady cam, you could ped down. You could do a lot more with two steady cams in the corners than typical handhelds, because there's no photographers. Yep. There's nobody in your way. You could own that area. And steady cams aren't that expensive, and they're easily rentable. It would have been a good way to get lower and closer to the game.
All right. Can you two geeks shut up for a second here? Here's
six people will six people will put a star beside that idea, Bob, and like the podcast for it.
Yeah, and they all work in television. Here's the problem with that idea, I don't really know what you're talking about. I mean, I can assimilate it sort of, but the problem is this: we assume COVID is not going to last forever, although maybe. So you experiment with these kinds of things that you've got, John, and next year you can't use it at all. And the dilemma becomes, if they are really good, now you can't go back to it.
Bob, if they're really good, there's always a way.
No, you can't. Then find the way without moving stands back.
Listen, doing it in a COVID environment. You move the stands back, Bob. And by the way, when you say we're going to have two rows of less seats, it's not the expensive ones that go away.
Mm. No, you just move those back up two rows.
That's right.
No,
it's
the cheap
ones that go away. I'm just saying, I agree with a bit of experimentation. But at the same time, I mean, I think that in order to try to, I think that's one of the biggest differences when the NBA is playing is that, you know, the ball is bigger. There's no glass or boards between the players and the cameras. And the sounds are more pure because of that.
No, they can do more. They can do more.
So they could do more. That's all I'm saying.
If you were still running Sportsnet, and I know a couple people here that wish you still were, I can't attest to any more than two, but
yes,
but two, well, it, maybe one and a half.
Who used to
one
be
and
on the
half?
Payroll? Yeah.
Would you have been more aggressive in new concepts?
I like to think that the team there was always trying to innovate. When we first got the contract in 2014, we pushed by our former CEO, Guy Lawrence. We really tried to come up with some new and different angles. That's how the ref cam came to be. I think this would have been an opportunity, but you're always constrained with logistics, right? And it's easy as outsiders now to talk about what they could have done, should have done. We don't know their budgets. We don't know what the league was doing. And remember, they're putting this together in a short timeline, right?
They've been meeting since May. They've had meetings since May. And this thing, when you talk about television costs, this thing costs between $50 and $70 million overall. Yeah. This is, you know, and so if you wanted to tell me that I wanted to spend another $300,000 on Steadicams, please, it's a drop in the bucket. If they had wanted to do it, they could have done it.
I think what I'm missing, and maybe it's out there and I haven't seen it, is bubble life. What's it like in the bubble? You know, I think that would be fascinating because, you know,
The teams have done a really good job with it on their digital stuff.
Some of it,
and the NHL's done it, and NBC is running it. NBC runs features on bubble life all the time.
We
don't see that in Canada. No.
Yeah, well, I think that might be a little bit of a miss because I was trying to explain to Becky, who both of you guys know as my wife, yesterday, that if I'm a veteran. Playing, and I was just using the NBA as an example yesterday. If I'm playing for the Nets yesterday, and I'm 35 plus, how hard am I really trying? Because I want to get the heck out of the bubble and get home and see my family. So I think that's one of the added interesting things about life in the bubble in both sports is. Yeah, you know, how motivated are, especially guys who've already won the Stanley Cup or who have got their contracts already guaranteed for next year? You know, they haven't seen their family or their kids in a long time. This is hardship, and you can say these guys make millions and millions of dollars, but they're in minimum security prisons right now.
By the way, there's no paychecks. There's no paychecks they're getting in the bubble. They're in the bubble right now. So now this is this has been an interesting time. It's been an interesting time, I think, since last November when Don got let go. Black Lives Matters and diversity, which we all have to be very respectful of. But in the last week or so, we've seen two incidents. Tom Brenneman in Cincinnati, who got caught with a hot mic, and Mike Milbury. And you're a CEO. You have been through these issues. How do you handle those? What's the internal discussion like when somebody says, we've got a problem, Scott, and you have to fix it, and you have to fix it before we go on the air tomorrow?
Yeah. I think those challenges have gotten more exasperated because of the political climate. I think as a CEO, as an executive, you used to be able to think, did Don or Tom or Mike intend to offend anybody? Now you have to think, was anybody offended? It's more about the receiver than the offender. And you have to be even more careful than you had been before. I went through one with Mike at Hockey Night in Canada when I was at CBC. He referred to the sissification of hockey, which he thought was a relatively harmless way of saying that it had gotten too gentle. And my boss at the time received a complaint from Rick Mercer, and he said to me, Scott, you'd better fix this. And there are various different ways you can try and fix it. In that situation, we got Mike to apologize. And sometimes that's how you solve it. I do think we need to be careful going forward that, and I don't like when people say political correctness is a bad thing. I think you have to be careful and you have to be sensitive to your audience. But for people to be fired for slips of tongues or things that they didn't mean to be offensive, in a very sensitive time, you know, are these fireable offenses? And sometimes I gotta think maybe they're not, but we're all, you know, very, very sensitive to our audiences, and for the most part, for the right reasons, right? I saw it happen and play out with Don, now with Tom Brenneman, which, by the way, there's one that we've solved. I don't know how many times, John, where we've told audio operators, just keep the mics closed during commercial breaks. You shouldn't have open mics in commercial. And by the way, anybody who's been in the business long enough should know, don't say anything stupid in front of an open mic, whether you think you're in commercial or not.
Yeah. Or just don't say anything stupid.
Well, that would be helpful. But we've all said stupid things, at various levels, right? Hopefully they're not offensive. Hopefully they're not hateful. When they are either of those two things, then you've got to deal with it.
So let's talk about the Brenneman one in particular, where he used a homophobic slur. Fox and the Reds were very quick to get him to apologize and get him off the air within the same game.
Yeah.
Which in my mind was commendable. Mm-hmm. What do you do now? And this is, we're talking the Brenneman name in Cincinnati. This is a legendary family. His dad, Marty, is in the Hall of Fame. Tom has already been taken off Fox football because of this.
Yeah.
Does he have any rope? Does he have a grace period? Is this a suspendable thing? Is this a fireable thing? What is it?
I would hope, now, unless there's a history that we're unaware of.
Right.
Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. If there is a history of saying stupid, homophobic things like that, then it's probably a fireable offense. If there isn't, maybe it's a suspendable offense. You come out, you do an apology, you make it sincere, you make sure there's some sensitivity training. Who was, Bob, who was the Blue Jays player who came out with the black underneath his eyes a couple of years ago?
Oh, the shortstop. The shortstop.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to remember.
It wasn't that. Reyes, was but, it?
No, it wasn't
Reyes. It'll come to me. But, that one, he apologized. It wasn't a great apology, but he apologized. And he took sensitivity training. The goalposts are moving for the right reason in our society that we need to be more sensitive in our language. But it takes time to make sure that everybody's up to speed and that people don't slip from time to time. I don't think it should be a death sentence. What would I have done with Milbury?
They've sent him home.
They sent him home. This one is the perfect example of, it's not about whether he intended to offend. It's the fact that a large number of people were offended by it. I think we all know what he meant to say. He meant to say, as a former coach, as a former general manager, it's sort of ideal to be in a bubble situation where there are no distractions. But he tried to do it in a funny way that's frankly no longer funny. It's like your uncle telling a joke that might have been funny in the 60s or might have been acceptable in the 60s, and some people laughed even though they knew it wasn't acceptable. Now you can't say those things. And, I think we're a better place because of it, but it's going to take time, especially for people who grew up in the 60s, 70s, where some of these things did get said, and they need to make sure that they know that you can't say them.
Let me throw my two cents in here as somebody who, spent 45 years on the air and never really got, surprisingly, into this kind of trouble. I mean, the worst trouble I got into was with Cito Gaston, and that had nothing to do with anything except that Cito thought I was a racist because I didn't like him.
Yep.
I think the word intent is really an important word here. And it's a difficult one because, an individual who makes a mistake can plead that he had no intent to offend and can just say it and not mean it. So it is up to somebody like you, Moore, to somehow determine whether the intent was real or was this a slip of the tongue. The thing is, broadcasters like us, and this environment is, in my mind, no different than broadcasting. I don't use profanity on this show. I could. Mm-hmm. I'm just trained not to. I can swear like a sailor when I'm off the air, but I'm not going to do it in this environment. But you're doing hours of live broadcasting, live talk. Sometimes things come out of people's mouths, and is there a person out there more? You, John, me, or anybody watching or listening to this that has not slipped at least once and mm-hmm. said something that they thought was funny or amusing or whatever, but turned out to be offensive? We've all done it. Mm-hmm. And to end a career because of that just seems to me to be a complete and total overreaction. And I believe that's where we are in the broadcasting industry today. Everybody is so afraid of their shadow that they're going to dump on somebody rather than take the heat. Agree or disagree?
I agree with you. I think what we're asking of broadcasters and their bosses is to deliver swift career death sentences for mistakes.
Yeah, exactly.
You can go rob a bank and you'll go to jail for a few years and you'll get out, hopefully reformed and not rob a bank again. So if you make a mistake that's not habitual, wasn't intentful, then maybe you should have a chance to apologize, move on. And that's tough when you've got the Twitterverse calling for heads every day.
The rush to judgment, Scott, the rush to judgment is really harsh.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something, and I know Don Cherry would not be upset with me relaying this story because I think it's very illustrative. So I can remember when we first got the contract and I went to go meet with Don in Vancouver. They were doing the outdoor game or the quasi-outdoor game in Vancouver. And I sat with them at the Westin in Vancouver and said, we wanted to hire him at Rogers. And I said, here's one of the differences that you're going to find working with Rogers is if you say something offensive at the CBC, people are going to write and people are going to get mad at the CBC. They're going to call the government and say you should stop funding the CBC. If you say something offensive at Rogers, there may be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that decide to stop subscribing to Rogers services because they're supporting you. So you're going to have to be even more careful about what you say. And I'll give Don a ton of credit that he was very much more careful when he came over to Rogers, and he was always aware of that. But, you know, he said something that was offensive to many, and there was a very loud call for swift movement on it. And what happened, and I've said publicly, whether you want to construe this as me supporting what he said or not, I'm not supporting what he said, but I think it's a tough way for his career to have ended. And I feel badly about that.
Let's clarify something here, because, you know, I know you know all the where all the bodies are buried on this, but, and Don was on with us, although we didn't get into it in any great depth. But the story is that Don was called in on, I believe, the Monday morning after the incident, which was, I think, a Saturday night, mm-hmm. and was given the opportunity to go on the air and apologize for what he said. He declined that opportunity. And as a result, the decision was made to terminate him. And I don't know this for a fact, but if 1 and 1 equals 2, that means that if he had agreed to apologize, he could have stayed on the air. Mm-hmm. Is that, as you understand it, John?
I believe that. Yeah. I think your timing is might be a little different, but yes, I believe that that was true. Yeah.
Scott Moore shaking his head a little bit. What do you think? What do you know?
I talked to Don. I think he would have apologized, but I don't know that he would have apologized in the way that Rogers would have needed to apologize.
Well, it would have had to have been scripted. Let's face it. It would have had to have been scripted. And Don would not have done that. The interesting thing about all of this is that broadcast executives have paid and want people to be polarizing. They want to create reaction. You know, Mike Milbury, who I've known Mike since he played, had some great discussions with Mike, had some great arguments with Mike. I don't agree with a lot of the things that Mike does, but, you know, Sam Flood at NBC hired him because he was Mike Milbury, not because he was milquetoast, not because he was the greatest analyst in the history of the game, but because he was Mike Milbury. And he crossed a line. He crossed a line that he should not have crossed.
No, but they asked. They're asking people to walk a tightrope, and then the minute they slip and fall off that tightrope, they want to get rid of them.
That's my point.
They want to save their own asses. That's what the problem is.
That's my point. That is completely my point. Is that this? You know, and I mean, NBC went through the same thing with Jeremy Roenick.
Yes.
You know, and so, at what point does the system get analyzed a bit better is my question. At what point, okay, so what are we doing? How are we hiring these people? Is this the right way to be hiring this type of person? Or philosophically, should we stop being much more editorial and more analysis as opposed to what some networks have now? I mean, it's an interesting one. I watched the golf yesterday. And there was not one ounce of criticism of anything, even if the guy shanked his wedge. There was not going to be. That's just not the way golf works. And, in other sports, particularly in the sport that we cover a lot in hockey, boy, oh, boy, you get paid to be negative. You get paid to be negative. And that's, Scott, to me, that's an issue.
Yeah, I think there's an extra problem. And the extra problem, and you have already identified it with Brenneman, there's a call for absolute instant or swift justice. Mm-hmm. And get that person off the air before the end of the game, or in Don's case, I think he was fired within 2 or 3 days. I would compare it maybe to how our friend Brad Treleving handled his coaching problem in Calgary when his coach was accused of uttering racial slurs, and people were calling for his head. And Brad said, "We're going to get to the bottom of this. You're going to have to be patient, because this is a man who's put years and years into his craft, and we're going to make sure that we have it all right before we make our judgment." And it took probably 3 or 4 days longer than most people wanted to. And they came to the conclusion that they were going to fire their coach. But they didn't do it based on the Twitterverse saying it has to be done now. Because you would not convict a person of robbing a bank in 24
hours. Without a trial.
And, you know, I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for people in my old position or who are running other networks, is that call for swift justice. We heard what he said. We know what he meant, or we know what she meant, and they have to be fired.
Well, how do you measure social media? I mean, I remember Jay Feaster, the former general manager of the Calgary Flames, had a great line one day when somebody asked him about a trade and this and that. And he says, "Listen, I am not going to respond to somebody who is 13 years old in his underwear in his basement." because, I mean, you can be nameless and faceless and throw something in social media, and who knows it's accurate and who knows it's fair, and yet it may get some life. So as a suit, when you're sitting there in your beautiful corner office with your 29 monitors and your Emmys and everything like that, not that I know that you had that, but how much did you measure what social media did? How much around the people around you measure social media?
Yeah, you have to use social media as a tool, not the final arbiter. But that's a whole other interesting issue, is how your staff, your commentators, are using social media themselves. Because how many people that we know of in the last 2 or 3 years have lost their jobs because of something stupid they've done on social media.
You know, I'm just trying to get free golf clubs.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, and Bob was brilliant at this in the last few years that he was at Rogers. You know, social media was swirling all around you, Bob, but you didn't participate. Nope. You just didn't participate. And, you know, there are a ton of people in our industry, too many in my opinion, who feel a need to engage on social media and argue on social media and respond to every troll. I have a rule. Like, if you don't agree with me, that's fine. You say something rude to me, I'm blocking you. And if you want to argue with me, I don't argue with people with less than 5 followers. Like, you know, you're just coming on there to be difficult. But there are people we know in this industry who want to engage with every critic on social media, and then you're asking for trouble somewhere down the road.
We could go on and on, and
this has been fun,
and more doubtless would go on and on.
It's just nice to be called by you, Bob.
You haven't gone back to visit your old office, and the reason I ask this is because I remember this vividly more when you wandered into Rogers for the first time and took over that corner office. Do you remember what you pledged? If not publicly, then privately. Because I was there when you pledged it.
Lifetime contract for Bob?
No. The office, well, he did say that, too. Well, I outlasted him at the very least.
Not by much, big boy.
No. Well, as soon as Moore left, that was the end of me. So, no, he had this big-ass office that was way too big for anybody, and especially Scott Moore, and pledged to reduce the size of it, cut it in half. Do you recall that?
I don't recall saying that, but yes. I do recall.
Yes, you did.
No. By the way, the guy that had the office before you was Doug Beforth. He's my college roommate and a friend of mine. But you know what you said to me about that office?
What? Me?
It has no. Scott. He said it has windows because Doug liked it dark.
Yeah.
You opened the blinds, and it was light outside.
Just because I loved that was such a great office. It was the size of my second apartment, probably. When Guy Lawrence came in, remember, he came in as the CEO of Rogers and said, "We're getting rid of all the offices and we're starting with Scott Moore's." Because when Beforth built the office, it was actually the biggest office in the entire Rogers building.
Fantastic.
So I'm proud to say that Guy got rid of a lot of offices, but by the time Guy was asked to vacate the building, I still had my office.
And
so
by the
he didn't
way,
get to me.
By the way, offices are coming back because of COVID.
They are. Absolutely.
The open concepts don't work in COVID.
I saw it coming. You could social distance like 20 people in that office.
Yeah,
that's right. Perfect.
Well, and for the first 5 years I worked for you, you did for me. So it's unbelievable.
Bob, it's good to see you. Congratulations on the podcast.
Well, it's, you know, it's what's something to do.
It's
and it's not, you know, it's not for me. It's for John, who has nothing to do and no true. Life whatsoever. And I've got, I've pledged to look after him for the rest of my miserable little life here, or his. And so that, hence,
we are recording and clipping that.
You look beautiful. We wish you continued success. And who knows, we may give you a dingle somewhere down the road and get you back on. We'll talk about some other stuff. All right. Okay. Well, you know what we should do? We should recruit Pelly at some point and have things two on at the same time.
Oh, that'd be fun. We have some good stories. We had some good Bob McCown stories.
And some of them might even be true.
Maybe there was a bad idea on my part then, now that I think of it.
Oh, he'll do it. He'll do it for sure.
The CEO of Uninterrupted Canada, the former president of Rogers Sportsnet, Scott Moore. We thank you for watching or listening wherever you are. Check us out next time.